Thanks for downloading from the BBC. Get more technology news at bbcnews.com and click on technology.
This is the BBC World Service, also podcasting via the BBC News website. Hello, I'm Gareth Mitchell and welcome to our weekly look at the world of technology. This is Digital Planet and today, modding your way to happiness with the hackers.
What you see is a friendly competition between people who build things and they're like, oh, check out how I modded. They're like, oh yeah, check out how I modded it. And the whole point is you not only show your mod, but you share how you did it.
Yes, lock up your favourite tech toys or you'll just take them to bits because that's his job. He and his chum tell us about open source hardware. It's all about sharing nicely, you see. And so is this.
You have two start menus. You have your window on the right. You can type on the keyboard. I'll be able to type at the same time.
Okay.
So we're typing. So you can be working on your mail.
Yeah.
And I could be checking cricket scores.
And that's because it's the computer equivalent of a tandem bicycle. All that and more right here on Digital Planet from the BBC.
Reports from Zimbabwe say several leading opposition activists have been assaulted after being arrested at a big rally in the capital, Harare, on Sunday. A lawyer for the detained opposition leader, Morgan Tsvangirai, said his client was one of those attacked while in detention.
Well, that's, of course, the troubled southern African nation of Zimbabwe, where opponents of Robert Mugabe's ruling ZANU-PF party say they've been attacked and physically assaulted after government forces broke up an opposition rally the weekend before last. The violence has escalated since then, and at the same time, it's become increasingly hard for people in the country to receive news and information. The authorities have pretty much banned any reporting and foreign journalists, including the BBC's correspondent, have been ejected. Some information is getting into the country, though, from the London-based SW Radio Africa station. But its shortwave transmissions have been blocked in Zimbabwe, although it does continue to broadcast online. And it's just started sending news updates out as SMS text messages to mobile phone subscribers in the country. Well, let's speak then to the station manager, Jerry Jackson, who is in London. Jerry, first of all, how are the authorities over there actually blocking your shortwave transmissions?
Hi, Gareth. Well, as far as we can ascertain, it's using Chinese equipment and expertise. We actually spoke to the wife of one of the soldiers who was apparently sent to China to learn how to use the jamming equipment. So we're effectively blocked in the main city centres, although our shortwave broadcasts do get into some of the rural areas.
And so you've hit on this idea now of sending text messages. So what does that involve then? Literally, if you're in Zimbabwe, you can use your phone and receive a message with some information on.
Absolutely. What we do each day is, as we're compiling news headlines for our shortwave broadcasts, we put those onto a text message and send them into Zimbabwe. And, of course, we've advertised it and asked people to just send us their numbers. It's a free service. And then they can get the daily headlines or breaking news alerts. As we found out when the opposition were brutalized two Sundays ago, the first people in Zimbabwe knew about it was from alerts that we sent in.
How many people have signed up for it?
We started in mid-December, and so far we've got 2,000, and we're adding to it at about 100 a day.
Let's get some response from Guy Clapperton. He's joining us this week as our studio expert. Guy, you're a freelance writer and broadcaster specialising in technology. You write quite a lot for the British National Press here. What do you make of this tech service?
Well, I think it's an excellent idea, clearly.
Sure.
It gives us a certain perspective on the fact that we in the West tend to think that it's very important to be really technically up there with all the latest technology, and actually with text you can do an awful lot, as Jerry has just said.
Yeah, it doesn't get much more technologically simple than a text message, does it, Jerry? The thing that concerns me, though, isn't it risky for these people who are receiving your messages in Zimbabwe to be getting them if they're caught with these messages on their mobile phones? Could they be punished themselves?
Gosh, anything can happen in Zimbabwe right now, but it's a little unlikely. The state is really pressurised and they're attacking everybody they can. But, I mean, you can just delete the message.
And what kind of messages are you sending out? Because I'm just thinking, obviously, the downside of this very simple technology is, you know, 160 characters. You are limited as to how much you can write.
Oh, that's a nightmare. We've become pretty good experts at pricing truly bleak news. I have to say we have the most fabulously bleak headlines on the planet. We just let people know what is happening, and of course we put our station ident on it so that it has credibility, so it's just not rumour. Because over the 5 years that we've been broadcasting, we have built up some credibility for reporting accurate facts and news. We're not trying to create alarm and despondency.
Final thought from you, Guy.
Yeah, Jerry, can I just ask what you're actually doing about security for your own database? If you've got all these numbers of people you're texting, if I were to put my name on that database and I were in a vulnerable state or a state where people are being hounded, I'd be quite concerned about what's going to happen to that data.
Yes, you know, but that's a very Western perspective. You've got a government under pressure that is sort of flailing around, and I don't know if they could really get the act together to do that, but we protect it as well as we can.
All right. Well, Jerry Jackson, thanks very much for joining us. That's Jerry Jackson, the station manager of SW Radio Africa. OK, well, now a wee transition for you. Let's have some of this. Yeah, it's right back to the early 90s, isn't it? Some acid loops there from a Roland synthesizer. And if you'd like one of those retro synths for yourself, well, tough. Roland only made a few of them, so you'll be lucky to get your hands on a second-hand one even. Still, never mind, you can always make one of your own. A hacker's taken one to bits, figured out how it all works and what you need to make it yourself, and has made DIY kits available online. She is Lee Moore-Fried, recently graduated in engineering from MIT, and she's a New York-based artist and writer. At last week's South by Southwest Interactive Festival in Austin, Texas, she shared the keynote session platform with Phil Terone, who's senior editor of the tech hobby and hacker publication Make Magazine. In their session, they described a number of projects like that DIY synth. And Lee Moore says it's all about what they call open source hardware.
Well, there's a lot of different levels of what can be open source. So one thing could be schematics and diagrams and parts list, and like literally you have to solder it together or you weld it together. But, you know, it can also be high level. For example, iPods, you can install Linux on an iPod, and that's actually, it is hardware, but because electronics have gotten so advanced, we can have chips that run Linux on them or full operating system on them. That's how you have a cell phone with Microsoft Windows on it. So even though that software, it's firmware, it's hardware and software together.
And before we hear about some of your projects, let's speak to Phil here as well, because this whole culture, if you like, of making stuff and sharing designs goes to the heart of your publication, Make Magazine. And I think there are 80,000, maybe 90,000 readers across the United States who would agree that it's a great thing to be able to mess around and construct and mash up your own hardware.
There's literally hundreds of thousands of people making bizarre things. Today we talked about VCR cat feeders, people modding things like a VCR so they could feed their cat, to things like Lamore was talking about, putting different operating systems on hardware you already own. We're seeing people around the world coming up with things that you never really expect, and they're sharing the how-tos, they're sharing the information, and people are participating.
And in your case, you've brought this into reality by, for instance, taking a synthesizer, like a well-known, like commercially available synthesizer, but making your own open source version that other people can build themselves, haven't you?
We took a Roland TB-303, which is a sort of well-known 1980s synthesizer, and it's not available anymore. They only sold 10,000. They stopped. But it's still in high demand, and so we said, let's reverse engineer the design, and we did that and designed a sequencer to go with it, and we're selling kits, and people assemble it themselves. But we're giving away the design and the firmware, that operating system inside the device. And so people who are musicians and they want to add a certain capability to the synthesizer, if you buy like a Moog synthesizer, or you buy a Roland nowadays or a Casio, you're kind of stuck with what they give you. You can sometimes add some new sounds, but the functionality is what they sell. But you know, the people who get this kit that I sell called the Zoxbox, they actually I have the ability to add new low-level functionality that they want in their music, and this is pretty new and exciting for them because you can't do this most of the time.
And so, Phil, I suppose in the same way that an open-source programmer might write a new little bit of code to improve whatever it is they're working with a synthesizer like this, they can say, oh, I've just come up with some op-amp or something or other that improves the sound of the synthesizer and plug that in and then share that improvement with other users.
Yeah, the way I like to look at it, there's a little bit of skateboard culture, if you've ever watched that. Everyone wants to outdo each other and they're like, check it out, I just did a different trick. Like, I did an ollie and a twist, or like I did a 360, kind of beat that. And so it's really neat to watch what happens. And like, people send it to each other, and they send it to her, and they send it to Make, and they're like, there's buttons and switches and knobs and like rotary phones that operate things. Like, what are they doing? Like, how much free time do they really have? But turns out a lot.
And it's just so, you know, so much fun watching it and you know, reading about it, and I guess doing it. That's the main thing. Just before you go, though, you have a really interesting device sitting on the table in front of you here.
Yes.
It's a laptop, but it's not just any old laptop, is it?
No, by a series of mistakes or clerical errors, we seem to have found ourselves at OLPC, and that's the one laptop per child laptop.
And I have to, I can't tell you how excited I am to see this, because we've been reporting on this whole thing on the programme for about 2 years since Nicholas Negroponte, formerly of MIT's Media Lab, announced the idea to bring an affordable laptop to school children in the world's poorest countries. And it's been talked about a lot, and part of us, you know, thought that we may never see it. But this is actually a working production model.
Yeah, it's real. It boots up. We've been playing around with it. They sent it to us so we would maybe turn some of the content we do at Make and some of the things that we do, how-tos, into content for it.
What's interesting is that the processor they used is, you know, a very well-known free core processor called the ARM32. And that's kind of neat because they're running Linux on it. And again, this is although they don't say this, it's they've set it up to be a very good platform for doing sort of firmware hacks, hardware hacks. It's a well-documented processor. There's a lot of software and firmware out there for this. So, you know, as is, it's a functioning laptop, but it would be interesting to turn this into other devices.
I bet they can't wait. That's Lee Moore Freed and also Phil Tyrone over there in Austin, Texas. Well, Guy Clapperton's in the studio now. And this puts hacking into a light that some people might not think of. We think of hacking into software and computer systems. This is actually physically hacking into the hardware and doing interesting stuff with it.
Yes, I keep having the word breaking into hardware and just breaking generally is a sort of image in my mind. That you have to be very, very sure about what you're doing if you're going to do any of this sort of stuff, or do it with something you don't particularly need. One of the people was saying there that she thought it was a good idea to be doing this with stuff you use for business. If somebody were to modify the computer that controls my payroll beyond use, I would not be very pleased at all personally. So I think, you know, be very, very careful.
Choose what you hack. I suppose I had a bit of a sort of early hacking career as a young physics student when I was about 13 or 14. I did hack into my parents' TV, and I managed to send sound that I'd originated myself from a tape recorder in the other room through the speaker of the TV, and it freaked my parents out and I got in trouble. I suppose on a kind of wider context, and as you say, in business, or if it's something that you really need and you need to know how to put it back together again, then unless you know what you're doing, be careful.
Absolutely.
But can this have benefits as well? I mean, the great thing that these guys are doing is that, you know, if they get somebody to build one of these Roland synthesizers, A, you end up with your own wherewithal to kind of make some cool music, but also I suppose you learn a bit about electronics.
Oh, of course you learn a bit about electronics. I think if it's used as a learning curve thing, it's an excellent idea. There is no substitute for actually taking something apart to see how it actually works. So yes, I would agree with that entirely.
Okay, all right. Well, Guy Clapperton, stay there. We'll be speaking to you again in a few moments here on Digital Planet. We're on air, online, and we're podcasting from the BBC World Service. I'm Gareth Mitchell. And still to come, the search for search is seeking out material online, about to get cleverer. But first, Microsoft's internet execution sucks. Its search sucks. Its advertising sucks. And no, that's not me saying it, but former technical evangelist at Microsoft, Robert Scoble. He made those comments on his popular Scobleizer blog recently. And Microsoft certainly has its enemies, not just from highly vocal former employees like Scoble, but from the aforementioned Google and also Yahoo and, of course, Apple. Yet Microsoft is still a massive force in the technology industry. So as part one of a two-parter, where we go behind the scenes of tech giants, IBM is next week, by the way, John Stewart's been getting access to the research labs at Microsoft's Redmond campus in Washington State in the United States.
This is really the hub of the company. It's the main headquarters of Microsoft. We've got about a little over 25,000 people here on this campus.
Kevin Schofield, General Manager, Strategy and Communications from Microsoft Research, is our guide on their Redmond campus.
As part of our commitment to global corporate citizenship...
As we move indoors through the reception, away from the typical Seattle rain, he explains some of what they're planning at their sites here in the US and in India, the UK and China.
And businesses reach their potential.
I think the future is going to move in lots of different directions. I think, you know, we certainly see more services available on the internet. There are some parts of the world where it's just not feasible to have a PC of any sort. I mean, we're looking at, you know, maybe in emerging markets, a smartphone is the right platform, and, you know, what kinds of applications we can build on there. I think computing is going to appear in our lives in different ways in different parts of the world.
Microsoft was founded in 1975, but at 32 years old, they wouldn't thank you for implying they're getting middle-aged or being left behind. Every year, they hold an event called TechFest for their researchers to show off their latest ideas to each other. This year, for the first time, they've allowed outsiders to have a look too. More than 100 innovations are on display, which could give an idea of the way the company's focusing. For example, how to compete with major rival Google.
I'm working here today with something called Gazing into Search. And the idea here is to take search results and use standard eye-tracking technology.
Ed Cutrell is from Microsoft here at Redmond. He's using sensors under the monitor that I didn't even notice were there to check how our eyes take in information on search result pages.
What have you found from the research? I mean, are we going to see web search pages changing anytime soon?
You may well. From our research, we found that increasing the amount of what we call the snippet, which is that little bit of information you see underneath the title, you can increase that fairly dramatically and show a lot more context. And that can be very, very useful in some cases. But if what you're trying to do is to find a web page, a specific web page,
say bbc.co.uk or microsoft.com,
then that extra context can be problematic. You wind up getting sucked into all this extra text, and you lose track of the really relevant information.
Just last week, Microsoft bought a voice recognition software firm, raising the prospect of spoken web searches. And researchers here are working on complementary technology. Compare this.
So I'm now sitting here with John Stewart from the BBC.
With this.
So I'm now sitting here with John Stewart from the BBC.
Mike Seltzer, researcher in the speech technology group, is working on stripping away background noise so that if you talk to your computer in a noisy environment, like a technology exhibition, it can still understand what you're saying.
So this is useful for person-to-person communication. You can imagine like a voice over IP telephony. This can be used in podcasting if people want to create their own podcast.
So they don't have to have a soundproof room at home.
Exactly, exactly.
Of course, if your computer talks back, you may not want the whole room to hear it. But maybe you don't always want to have to use headphones.
Once you can control where the audio goes in the room, you can deliver it to a target user while everybody else doesn't hear what's going on.
This is a project called Personal Audio Space and uses an array of 16 small speakers rather than one large one.
Hi, I'm Yasha Drapo. I'm a researcher in the Redmond Lab for Microsoft Research. The design criteria was it was the cheapest 2-inch speaker driver I could find.
Cost-cutting even at Microsoft.
With a single speaker cone, what you get is like water flowing into the room. It just goes everywhere. And with multiple speaker cones, what we can do is start to control where the audio is going through the software in the computer.
I put that to the test by playing the Digital Planet podcast.
Okay, so we're standing straight in front of it now, and I can hear it quite clearly. Where should I go now?
So take about a meter to your right.
Yeah. Can't hear a thing, actually.
I work in the Technologies for Emerging Markets group at Microsoft Research in India. So we're looking at how technology can kind of like aid in low-income communities.
Uday Singh Pawar is working on research that could give you two computers for one.
You can see on the screen like this. One side is like one desktop, other side is the other desktop.
There are a lot of situations where one computer is shared because of the expense of getting another PC and monitor. But a mouse and keyboard are relatively cheap. So he's come up with a plan to split computing power and split the screen down the middle and run each half separately for each user.
You have two start menus. You have your window on the right. You can type on the keyboard. I'll be able to type at the same time.
Okay.
So we're typing together.
Type at TechFest. All right. Can't type very well there. If I click on my start menu, that doesn't affect your side of the screen.
No, it doesn't. So you can be working on your mail. Yeah. And I could be checking cricket scores.
Well, perfectly good use for the computer, especially with the Cricket World Cup going on at the moment. So that report was from John Stewart. And talk there, of course, in that Microsoft conference about different kinds of search. And as we all know, search engines are great at finding words, but that's very different from actually locating meaning. If you're interested, for instance, in elephant anatomy and you do a search on the word trunk, for instance, you'll probably get information on trunk routes for traffic or the trunks that Americans take to mean storage spaces in their cars. But the difficulty goes beyond just cases where something you want happens to have a word with more than one meaning. What if you want something with a certain colour, or something that looks like something, or music that sounds like something? Enter semantic searching and a team at the University of Southampton on England's south coast. In charge is senior lecturer Kirk Martinez.
At the moment, you would have to visit lots of websites if you wanted to look up Renaissance sculpture, for example, and you would probably have to sign up for some of those websites, and you might miss some. With our system, what we do is we get software to put a semantic web layer on top of every museum. This means that the software understands what's in each museum and can go and gather up all the names of the painters, all the names of the items, where they were made, things like that, automatically, without having to try to guess or use keywords. So in our system, once you have done this, you can browse much more easily and also find things more easily without just having to put keywords in.
And you've got a demo of that, haven't you? You've been working on it?
Yes, that's right. We've got a combination of technologies here, but this is joining up photograph libraries from around Europe with some museums. If we search for chairs, for example.
Right, so you're typing in chairs. That's a very general search. There's a lot of chairs out there in picture databases and in museums.
That's right, and sometimes you'll find quite a cluttered scene with a chair in the corner. And you'll wonder.
True to form, look, about 8 different pictures of chairs have sprung up onto the screen, and I think you can scroll down through just about every chair known to humankind.
And that's partly because it's actually going across many different collections, as Google would, but in this case, we have only really got things that have been labelled with the word chair.
So you mean here that the archivist at a museum or somebody who's curating a website or a database with pictures on, well, you know, when they add whatever it is to the database, then they attach certain values, certain tags, as you call them.
That's right. So what our software has to do is get different people's information and join it up. And a classic one might be the author. Some museums will label the author of every item, and another museum might call it the creator. And so we have to get software to understand what all these mean, which is one thing, which is a person who makes things. And in the case of the content of an image, computers are still very, very simplistic. They can't really understand that these are chairs. They'll just see some colours and some shapes. So the way we've approached being able to find things inside the image, which you can do by tagging, so again, you could get millions of people to look at these pictures and say, there are 2 chairs, there are 2 tables, look at the picture and analyse and put tags on. In this case, we're trying to use the actual visual characteristics by the computer looking at the colours and shapes in the picture and storing that information so that we can search. So in this case, I'll give you a simple example. If we add from this colour palette here, if we choose the colour red, just from a colour palette, yeah, join that up with the word chair.
That's very interesting. It's not as if you've had to actually type in red as a word. You've actually got a palette of colours and you click on, in this case, a really nice, sumptuous red, and it's doing a search. And then, look at that, loads of red chairs pop up onto the screen.
Yes, and in this case, of course, you wouldn't necessarily have the word red in the text that describes the scene. So there are some scenes here that just say scene in a bedchamber. There's no word red, but the image does have red in it, so that gets picked out.
That's Kirk Martinez. So, Guy Clapperton, a technology expert, still here in the studio. How far do you think these Southampton people have gone towards solving these big problems of search?
I think it's a wonderful idea. Unlike you, I haven't actually seen the what they're doing, so I don't want to claim that I know how far they've got, but it sounds fabulous. We've all sat there in front of various well-known search engines, typed in a few keywords and come up with 16,000 or, you know, 1,600 pages or something. We know that by the end of the first 5, they're going to be a waste of time.
And it does highlight that very important distinction between just words and meaning. And of course, what we want from our search engines is meaning, not just a load of useless words.
Absolutely. About 15 years ago, I was working in the computer trade press, and some people were working on something called fuzzy logic, which was the idea that people would mistype things when they were searching for things and things like that. And so they were trying to make it even broader. I think these guys are trying to narrow it down, which is the opposite approach, but I think it's probably more useful.
And as we heard in that example there, searching not not just for words like, you know, red in red chair, but actually using colour, clicking on a palette and saying, that's the colour of chair I want.
Well, how useful is that if you're dyslexic? It's starting to sort of come into, you know, get other people who want to use other things than words. I mean, I write for a living, so the web as it stands is great for me. If this broadens it out so it's better for other people, brilliant.
And before that piece, we heard John Stewart's report from the Microsoft Labs there, and what to me sounded like a very interesting idea, that you kind of split a computer up so two people can use it by basically having the single screen on that computer showing images, separate images, to two different users. What do you think?
I think I'm getting it very childish here because it's my computer and I want it for me. But the reason I want that is because if I've got a wide screen and I've got my Word document in the middle and perhaps a Skype thing down the side and another text, instant messaging thing down the other, I do take up the whole screen. It will require people to use computers in a different way from the way they do now.
And I suppose it make a very good point there, isn't it? Because we tend to forget just how cluttered our screens are now compared to maybe a few years ago, all these toolbars and stuff that we're given to use.
Yeah, because a few years ago, computers weren't actually powerful enough to handle those toolbars at the same time. Now you can run about 57 billion programs at the same time. We all think we can cope with that. Our brains probably can't, but we do have them all on the screen at the same time.
So I just wonder if the clever bit behind this system, given that we have these, you know, comparatively powerful computers now, it's technologically reasonably easy to get the same computer to be operated by two different people, or actually many different people, technically. The tricky part is how we adapt to it as users.
Yes, I mean, if I were to be designing something like the Microsoft example from the ground up, I'd be saying, great, but let's attach two monitors to it.
Because it's technologically possible, isn't it? You can then use
two different desks and still be comfortable, but have the one computer in the middle taking up half the power that the two computers would have.
Right, so if I end up having a computer that I can share, I may not share it with you, Guy. Nothing personal, but as you say, you're not so keen on sharing.
I take that entirely personally, but don't worry about that.
Guy, thanks for sharing the programme with me this week. This is Guy Clapperton, I beg your pardon, Guy, technology expert. It's nice to have you along. That's it for this week. Colin Grant's the producer. I'm Gareth Mitchell. See you in 7 days' time. Bye-bye.